Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
It's June the 6th, 2014, and this is The Last Word. My name is Michael Lawson, and I am broadcasting today from Raleigh, North Carolina, from the North Carolina Democratic Party headquarters. In fact, I'm sitting in the same chair where a lot of people have sat, who have sat in front of our new chair. Well, he's not that new. He's not that old either. But he's been here and has done a great job for the Democratic Party. But you will be hearing from him later, because today's a special day. Today is D-Day. Does everybody know what D-Day was? What D-Day is? Did you learn that in school? Because you should have. This is the day when we had over 160,000 troops run, push, and land on the beaches of Normandy. And what we are going to hear in the meantime is a promo that led into that great, great, General Eisenhower said, this is a great crusade. And you're going to hear a portion of those speeches from Chamberlain, who actually gave away half of Europe because he did not want to confront the Reich and Hitler. As a matter of fact, he sat down with Hitler and trying to make sure that they didn't get everything that they wanted. Hitler sort of laughed at it. Hitler did laugh at it. For the next 5 minutes, I want everyone to think about if they had relatives who served in World War II, where they were at if they were still alive during the June the 6th, 1944. Were you alive? Did your father go? Did your brother go? Did they go to the Pacific? Well, we were fighting two fronts, you remember, on two different oceans, the Atlantic and the Pacific. But here is what the beginning of our tribute to the D-Day invasion. The Normandy landings, codenamed Operation Neptune, were the landing operations on the 6th of June, 1944. It was the Allied invasion of Normandy, Operation Overlord, during World War II. It was the largest seaborne invasion in history and began the invasion of German-occupied Western Europe, which led to the restoration of the French Republic and contributed to an Allied victory in the war. Planning for the operation began in 1943. But in the months leading up to the invasions, the Allies conducted a substantial military deception, codenamed Operation Bodyguard, to mislead the Germans as to the date and the location of the main Allied landings. Using captured German codes and double agents, they sent messages to German intelligence indicating that the invasion army was much larger than it actually was, and that the main attack would come at Calais in northern France. They also played up the possibility of other attacks from Norway, Italy, the south of France, Greece, and the Balkans. Because the Germans were not sure where the invasion would come, they had to keep all their garrisons manned and could not concentrate their resources on any one spot. They guessed wrong. The Germans concentrated on Calais because of the great ports and landing areas. The ruse went far beyond simple misinformation, however. The Allies created a bogus army, the 1st United States Army Group, codenamed Operation Quicksilver, that went to enormous lengths to make the Germans believe that they were actually full of thousands of men. Indeed, their army was initially filled with men assigned to real armies preparing for Operation Overlord. Meanwhile, British intelligence created inflatable tanks and plywood battleships to accompany the tent city and base where the army was supposedly housed. Care was taken to move the vehicles at night and add tire tracks when possible to simulate activities. To make sure that the Germans were completely deceived, they placed a real general at the head of this fictitious army, the 1st United States Army Group. His name was General George S. Patton, a man renowned for his toughness. The Germans regarded Patton highly and were convinced that he would lead the assault on Europe. Since his forces appeared ready to attack Calais, the Germans dare not move or transfer any soldiers from Calais to Normandy, where the attack actually happened. Patton played his role well. D-Day, June the 6th, 1944, the amphibious landings were preceded by extensive aerial and naval bombardment, along with an airborne assault of 24,000 British, U.S., and Canadian airborne troops shortly after midnight. Allied infantry and armored divisions began landing on the coast of France starting at 06:30 hours. The target was a 50-mile stretch of Normandy coast, where they divided it into five sectors: Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword Beach. However, bad weather and strong winds played havoc with the landings, especially at Utah and Omaha Beach, blowing the landing craft east of their intended positions, which cost many Allied lives. The Normandy landings were the largest seaborne invasion in history, with nearly 5,000 landings, an assault craft, 289 escort vehicles, and 277 minesweepers participating. Nearly 160,000 troops crossed the English Channel on D-Day, with 875,000 men disembarking by the end of June. Some experts say that the death of soldiers and civilians from fighting, disease, and starvation in World War II could have reached as high as 100 million. Right now is our senior producer, Mr. Introduce Yourself, Thomas Fortenberry.
Hey, this is Thomas. Hi, guys.
Hi. I hear you clear. Was that clear? It's because we don't have a great signal here. I got two bars.
Did it was mostly clear. I think it only warbled a few times, but that's fine.
You just right then. So we don't have such a good signal here, but anyway, we're going to. I thought I'd give a layout of what actually happened during D-Day, and right now we are going to play a compilation of Chamberlain, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Eisenhower, and closing with Roosevelt. These were speeches that they made after Chamberlain found out, when he looked into his eyes and he didn't see anything looking back at him. It was almost the same thing. Didn't somebody else say, "I looked into their eyes and saw their soul"? Who's the one that said that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, Chamberlain looked into Hitler's eyes and he told, Hitler asked him, "Did you ever serve in the army?" And he says, "No, I served the government." And Hitler says, "I served in the army. I saw what men had to go through, men dying because you government officials sent us into war when you didn't have to do that, when you could have prevented this whole thing." And he says, "What do you want?" He says, By the way, as long as you keep polling, we'll be very glad. Well, that was the last time Hitler ever met with any allied person in charge of any. And Hitler, as soon as the man was out the door, he says, oh, yeah, invade.
Right.
And when, back to the point where Churchill had been fired, and when they found out that Hitler just ignored what the old man said, they called back Churchill as head of the Admiralty again. And he said, I told you for 4 years this man was the devil and you didn't listen to me. And then before you knew it, Churchill had become prime minister and Chamberlain was going away. So this is how we're going to start this. You're going to hear from Chamberlain, Prime Minister of England.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning. His action shows convincingly that there is no chance of expecting that this man will ever give up his practice of using force to gain his will. He can only be stopped by force. And we in France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack upon her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
On Friday evening last, I received His Majesty's commission to form a new administration. It was the evident wish and will of Parliament and the nation that this should be conceived on the broadest possible basis, and that it should include all parties, both those who supported the late government and also the parties of the opposition. I have completed the most important part of this task. A war cabinet has been formed of 5 members, representing with the liberal opposition the unity of the nation. The 3-party leaders have agreed to serve either in the War Cabinet or in High Executive Office. The 3 fighting services have been filled. It was necessary that this should be done in one single day on account of the extreme urgency and rigor of events. Sir, to form an administration of this scale and complexity is a serious undertaking in itself. But it must be remembered that we are in the preliminary stage of one of the greatest battles in history, that we are in action at many points in Norway and in Holland, that we have to be prepared in the Mediterranean, that the air battle is continuous, and that many preparations have to be made here at home. In this crisis, I hope I may be pardoned if I do not address the House at any length today. I hope that any of my friends and colleagues or former colleagues who are affected by the political reconstruction will make all allowances for any lack of ceremony with which it has been necessary to act. I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might and with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory there is no survival. Let that be realized. No survival for the British Empire. No survival for all that the British Empire stood for. No survival for the urge and impulse of the ages that mankind will move forward towards its goal. But I take up my task with buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. At this time, I feel entitled to claim the aid of all. And I say, come then, let us go forward together with our united strength. What General Weygand has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour. When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottom boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British Expeditionary Force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary, for years. If necessary, alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. Great air battle, which has been in progress over this island for the last few weeks, has recently attained a high intensity. It is too soon to attempt to assign limits either to its scale or to its duration. We must certainly expect that greater efforts will be made by the enemy than any he has put forth. Hostile airfields are still being developed in France and the Low Countries, and the movement of squadrons and material for attacking us is still proceeding. It is quite plain, sir, that Herr Hitler could not admit defeat in his air attack on Great Britain without sustaining most serious injury. If, after all his boastings and blood-curdling threats and lurid accounts trumpeted round the world of the damage he has inflicted, of the vast numbers of our air force he has shot down, so he says, with so little loss to himself, if after tales of the panic-stricken British crushed in their holes, cursing the plutocratic Parliament which has led them to such a plight, if after all this his whole air onslaught were forced after a while tamely to peter out, the Führer's reputation for veracity of statement might be seriously impugned. We may be sure, therefore, that he will continue as long as he has the strength to do so, and as long as any preoccupations he may have in respect of the Russian Air Force allow him to do so. On the other hand, the conditions and course of the fighting have so far been favorable to us. I told the House 2 months ago that whereas in France our fighter aircraft were wont to inflict a loss of 2 or 3 to 1 upon the Germans, and in the fighting at Dunkirk, which was a kind of no man's land, a loss of about 3 or 4 to 1, we expected that in an attack on this island we should achieve a larger ratio. This has certainly come true. It must also be remembered that all the enemy machines and pilots which are shot down over our island or over the seas which surround it are either destroyed or captured, whereas a considerable proportion of our machines and also of our pilots are saved and soon again, in many cases, come into action. The gratitude of every home in our island, in our empire, and indeed throughout the world, except in the abodes of the guilty, goes out to the British airmen who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
Many American-owned ships have been sunk on the high seas. We have wished to avoid shooting. But the shooting has started. And history has recorded who fired the first shot. In the long run, however, all that will matter is who fired the last shot. Hitler has often protested that his plans for conquest do not extend across the Atlantic Ocean, but his submarines and raiders prove otherwise. And so does the entire design of his new world order. For example, I have in my possession a secret map made in Germany by Hitler's government, by the planners of the new world order. It is a map of South America and a part of Central America, as Hitler proposes to reorganize it. Today in this area, there are 14 separate countries. But the geographical experts in Berlin have ruthlessly obliterated all existing boundary lines. They have divided South America into 5 vassal states, bringing the whole continent under their domination. And they have also so arranged it that the territory of one of these new puppet states includes the Republic of Panama and our great lifeline, the Panama Canal. That map, my friends, makes clear the Nazi design not only against South America, but against the United States as well. Nobody who admires qualities of courage and endurance can fail to be stirred by the full-fledged resistance of the Russian people. Russia needs all kinds of help. The needs of her huge armies will continue, and our help and British help will also continue. That is his plan. It will never go into effect.
Senators and representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Cut off from the whole thing by a layer of clouds. All I can see are a few ships shooting like mad at something. But the mist is closing in again.
Above the English Channel, Bert Stiles strains to survey the scenes on the beaches below.
There's not a speck of flak. I guess all the flak guns are leveled, waiting for our guys on the ground.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. You will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened. He will fight savagely. Has turned. confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory.
All right, that was a small bit of what actually went on leading up to D-Day. And we have right now on Thomas, are you still with us?
Definitely.
Okay.
You know,
and,
I have to tell you, I absolutely love the oratory skills that our leaders used to do.
You mean... They didn't say, yeah, and I was, yeah. They didn't do that?
Well, I mean, when you listen to Churchill, or especially Churchill, he's a master, but FDR, their skill with words, the way they can draw their audience in and paint a picture and make it for all of humanity and for civilization itself. I mean, it's beautiful. And you can tell that they were raised in the old tradition of, you know, like Latin oratory, when they would have actual debate clubs and train people to think and debate live. And that's something that we don't have anymore. You know, now you have speech writers, and you don't have to think on your feet. You can read the teleprompter and things like that. But their skills, amazing. Just some of their phrases and things that they said.
You mean they didn't say, like, fool me once, fool me twice, or fool me never again?
Yeah.
mean, they didn't say that?
They didn't quite have the strategery down, but they had some words. That's true.
You know, when I talk about, and we're going to have a gentleman here who can talk about all this. And he just called in. He's going to be on in a minute, but I wanted to
get
straight.
Can I read one thing that another master of the oratory said? This was President William Jefferson Clinton
on
the 50th anniversary of D-Day. But he said something that I love, too, about what was accomplished then. He says, "We know that progress is not inevitable, but neither was victory upon these beaches. Now, as was then, the inner voice tells us to stand up and to move forward. And now, as then, free people must choose." And that's absolutely true, because that wasn't an easy thing we did. We didn't just roll in there with our superior arms and our superior numbers and all the Germans laid down. You know, it was a butcher's row. I mean, we lost a substantial amount of people. But it does take choice, and I love that Clinton said that.
Right now, joining us is a gentleman who knows and has seen plenty of comment, and it's the award-winning journalist and writer, Mr. Joe Galloway. Are you with us, Joe?
I'm with you.
Well, as I already said, we lost 10,000 men before 12 noon. 12,000 totally in 12 hours we lost invading Normandy. 12,000 men. And every one of those men knew that they weren't going to come back. They might not come back. There was a gentleman I was listening to today before I drove here to Raleigh. He is a he was with the company he was with. They were the first. They were the first ones to come in and land on the beach. Before they got in their little dinghies that they went in, he remembers his captain telling him. He says, "Okay." He says, "One." He says, "One, two, three. You're dead. One, two, three. You're dead." As he went down the line, he was pointing to every third person was going to die. And this guy said, "You know, I was number two. So, but I got hit very badly when I got on shore, and there was this guy who." He was not a medic, but he helped me. I laid on the beach, and shells with fragments were going off all around. But they were able, the second wave, he laid on the beach and waited for the second wave to come in. Medic came in and helped him to come in. They wrapped him up, and they fixed him up, sent him to the hospital, and sent him back. He went back. I don't know if he went to Italy or where, but he didn't go into France. But today, Joe, and you have probably seen this as well as I have, back then in World War I and World War II, when you got shot, you normally were very bad and would die. Today, we are getting more from Vietnam on. Because of the vast medical improvements, we save more people's lives. But that means there's more people in the VA. And that means
there's
more people.
That is certainly true.
And we
I talked to a Marine.
A Marine
landed
on Iwo Jima.
And he was backside, not on the beaches,
on the beaches
and climbing 250 feet up.
Right.
Near the top, he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
They had to lower him back down ropes. And he lay at the bottom for several hours, and then he was put on a landing out to a hospital ship. They sort of patched him up, and the hospital ship, when it got a full load, went to Guam, and then from there to Hawaii, from Hawaii to San Francisco. I think he said it took 2.5 months for him to reach the Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, the helicopter... And the advances in modern medicine, modern pharmacology, you know, you can be absolutely shot in the stomach 3 or 4 times and be bleeding to death. And the combat medics have a shot they can give you that will stop the bleeding internally until you can get to a surgeon. So the advances in medicine are so great.
Well, you know, the thing is that, and we have it, these doctors, my wife works in the VA, so I know the improvements, and she's been a registered nurse for, especially with ICU and emergency room. The advances they have today, I mean, they're like night and day from World War One, but they're almost like night and day from Vietnam to now. And the thing is that the doctors have had the improvements, but the facilities are overwhelmed because there's not more facilities, and they have not improved the facilities. What do you think about that, Joe?
Well, we without question have problems in the VA system. What's going on right now with the long delays in getting treatment is a shortage of doctors, a shortage of staff, a shortage of money, but no shortage of patients. We have added more than 3 million eligible veterans for VA health care in the last 5 years, between 1 million from our two ongoing long-standing wars and 2 million who were low-priority Vietnam veterans who were given access to cheap medicine and some health care at the VA, and it just overwhelmed the system. But this is nothing new. The system has been overwhelmed for decades.
Absolutely, for over 25 years. The thing is, though, that the regressive government that we have in now on the federal level and the state level, they have not passed the increase in funding for the VA. They say they have. These people who have never served a decade, never served a day in their life, failed to put through the money that's needed to build more facilities. And the The facilities they have are 1970 facilities. The doctors and the equipment is 2050, but the facility is 1950.
Yeah.
And we
it's criminal what's going on. The Republicans in the Senate blocked a bill that would have built 27 more VA hospitals desperately needed, and they just flat blocked it, and those same senators will now stand up and weep over the failures of the VA. The hypocrisy is belt buckle deep and rising.
Well, and you know what makes me so sick is that General Shinseki had to take the fall for that. And you know, all right, somebody always takes the fall, but
somebody always takes the fall, but they never point the fingers at the politicians who caused the problem in the first place.
Of course.
You know, I know General Shinseki is a personal friend of long years, and I can't think of a single person better qualified to do that job at the VA. He just didn't get the support he needed. He didn't get the money he needed. He did the best he could, and in fact, I would tell you that Rick Shinseki, General Shinseki, you know, is the finest VA director they ever had. He's probably better than all the rest of them combined, and he has to fall on his sword because of a bunch of mealy-mouthed politicians.
Yep, no, you're absolutely correct. Yeah, absolutely.
If you don't think Shinseki had his heart in that job, I would tell you what he told me last month when I spent a couple of hours with him. He said, I have been carried off the battlefield on the backs of soldiers two times. And you know I love soldiers. You know I have to love soldiers. They saved my life. They carried me wounded from the battlefield on their back.
And
I have a great deal of respect for him, and I have none for those senators who blocked the bill to give the VA 27 more hospitals, and they did that in February.
Well, and the this thing is all about not letting anything be accomplished under this president. And, you know,
exactly.
This thing is what is the Thomas Dante's Inferno? They're saying I'd rather serve in hell than serve one day in heaven. Is that the way it goes?
I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven.
Than serve in heaven.
But
these
yes,
would rather destroy this government and redo it in their own criminal way. It's a disgrace. It's really a disgrace. And I know, Joe, tell us something about when you were in Vietnam and what some of these people went through in the makeshift hospitals that you have seen.
You know, the level of the level of care on the part of the combat medics was, you know, they did their best to try to save lives out there on the battlefield, but they mostly, you know, they had some IV fluid, they had the bandages and some tape and a pair of scissors, some morphine, and that was about it. The real doctor on that battlefield was the helicopter pilot. And if you were bad wounded, you were within 10 or 15 minutes of a MASH, a tent hospital, if you will, where there were surgeons and nurses, and they could start the repairs. But you had to go from there to a bigger MASH or to a hospital ship, or to an airplane that would fly you to Japan or the Philippines, where you could get to a big, proper hospital. So you were still a long way away from good care.
Yeah. Well, I know they had great care at Clark Air Base. When I was there, it was my home base, and we were TDY out to Da Nang and Cameron Bay. But I know they had a pretty good hospital at Da Nang also. But the thing is that today, as we said before, today's warfare, more people survive. And this, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out if you're going to have more people survive, you need more facilities at home.
Absolutely. You know, we're bringing home triple and quadruple amputees from the battlefield, these are people that we're obliged to take care of for the rest of their lives. You know, people talk about the Iraq War costing $3 trillion. They don't know. They don't know what the final cost is going to be, because you're going to have to care for 40,000 wounded, many of them quite badly wounded by the improvised explosives that were the enemy's weapon of choice. And because of the advances in medicine, people who would have died on the battlefield, just simply bled out, are being saved. For what kind of an existence, I'm not sure. And I think if I were a quadruple amputee and I had a vote, I think I might vote to ask them just to let me die.
Yeah, well, a lot of them probably would and didn't know they would ever wake up, and they did wake up. And
they
we
did
have,
wake up, and they woke up to a very bleak future.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that I know, as I said, my wife works at the VA clinic here, And they're supposedly, I think I just heard something where they're going to, they're now going to build a major hospital. She told me that a year or so ago here in Charlotte. But the thing is that she said that they are still working every single day. They're getting as many Vietnam patients as Iraqi and Afghan patients. And the Vietnam patients said that, you know, we should have priority because we were here first, and we're just getting the okay to come to the VA. Now,
only under General Shinseki, he opened up and let 2 million of the Vietnam veterans into the system, and at the same time, you've got 1 million coming in from Afghanistan and Iraq.
That's right.
So we owe them a sacred obligation to take care of their health needs. We promised them we would do so, and by God, we have got to deliver.
Absolutely. And why wasn't this opened up to the other, to the Vietnam vets before General Shinseki got there?
They just, because of the lack of money, they had to prioritize. They had to say, okay, there are 3 million Vietnam veterans, so we're going to say that those who were only mildly wounded or don't have some sort of continuing health problem, we're not going to take care of them. And they were, you know, on the battlefield, when you're wounded, and the first doctor who looks at you performs something called triage. He looks at you and he says, okay, he's got a chance, put him on the table. And he looks at the next guy and he says, no, he's too bad off, he'll probably die, leave him.
Yeah.
Well, they get triaged twice or three times now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And it's just plain the facts, and getting the money out of Congress is almost impossible.
Well, before I let you go, well, tell us something about what your memories are of D-Day.
Oh, you know, I was my dad and five of his brothers. Four of my mother's brothers were all in uniform and away during the war. I was born 3 weeks before Pearl Harbor, and I did not meet my father until the end of 1945 when the war was over. And all of my uncles came home as well, minus one. All of them had been wounded. But my first memories were growing up in houses full of frightened women. My mother and I lived between her mother's house and my dad's mother's house, and so did the other wives and children. So my memories are of frightened women looking out the window for the telegraph boy, and they never knew when he might come.
Yeah.
But D-Day, as best I can remember, was a happy day. I think it was almost a celebration of the beginning of the end of this war.
Mm-hmm.
It had gone on for the Americans at least for nearly 4 years, and in another year it would be over. So once we got our feet on European soil, headed for Germany, we had them on the run. But it was going to be a long, hard year getting there.
Well, we lost over 400,000 plus men. I mean, in 12,000 the first day. Eisenhower, before he made that speech to his men, he already wrote a speech that he had in his pocket that was going to be sent to President Roosevelt, that resigning, because he said that it didn't turn out. The landing didn't turn out how they expected. So
he had written a statement for defeat.
Right.
He had written a statement and said, I take all responsibility on myself. He is a remarkable commander.
Absolutely. He never went to the D-Day celebration. The first one, I think, was 1954 because he said he did not want to celebrate anything that was a major, major emotional event for him. And he went to Camp David, his favorite.
Yeah.
And we know, not that there's something wrong with anybody that hasn't served, in service of one shape or another. The problem I have with these chicken hawks is that they can blast somebody for not doing and not respecting the flag just to show that they respect the flag because they wear a flag lapel.
They're happy to vote to send somebody else's kids and grandkids to go fight and die, but they didn't go, and their kids won't go, and they're hypocrites and bastards. What can I say?
Well, hey, that's a good saying. That's plain talk. That's right. And one other thing.
That's what these people, it takes a hypocrite to sit there and vote to cut the funding and then turn around and attack the people for, you know, not helping the soldiers that they sent to war. So he calls it exactly right. They have no honor. There's not a shred of dignity among any of them.
Well, go ahead, Joe. The thing that bothers me is that when you have these same people who vote against the anything that has to do with helping our Vietnam vets, but yet they will help a company to frack all of North Carolina. These are the same people. And to frack North Carolina and poison the well water through the entire state. I mean, these are the same people. So
yeah,
I know,
they certainly are, and they're whores.
You're absolutely correct. And I know I've taken up. What are you doing today, Joe? Are you in any area for a D-Day, or are you just relaxing today?
Not today. I'm at home packing up. I'm heading for D.C. for the week to do some work up there at Fort Belvoir and taking it easy on a beautiful, sunny North Carolina late spring day.
Well, that's the only way to do it. And I want you to say hello to Dr. Grace Galloway, and tell her, who is a Vietnam vet, by the way. And say hello to her. And I thank you for giving us this time, Joe. And always welcome to have you call in anytime.
All right. Thank you, and take care.
Thank you, Joe. That was Joe Galloway, who is one of the finest reporters that ever was on the that ever picked up a pencil. He was a Vietnam reporter, and he was just unbelievable. He was a major, major person. Now, I need to see who did I lose here? I lost somebody. But by the way, we'll be talking to right now. We have Miss Robin Bradford, who is the chair of the County Democratic Party. How are you? Are you on your way?
I'm traveling.
Yeah, well, you're breaking up.
You can tell she's traveling.
Am I still breaking up?
No, you're all right now.
Okay. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
We also have on the line that mightier than pen, because he uses a computer, that mightier than pen columnist with the bad tongue, Mr. David Adams.
How are you, Michael? Thomas, how are you, sir? And hello to your guests as well.
Yes, so I understand that, what do you say, the pen is mightier than the sword, so your tongue is mightier than the sword? Is that what they're saying now?
I've been told that in the past, Michael.
Well, that's a whole different conversation, so let's go.
Yeah. We'll be good. Robin, what are you on your way up here to do? Tell the listeners.
Well, this weekend in Raleigh is our Democratic State Convention, and also on Saturday we're going to be celebrating our Jefferson annual dinner fundraiser. So we're going to be doing some Democratic business, hopefully making sure that we're able to support tickets from the top to the bottom.
Now, how has it been looking for Democrats getting out and voting this year? I mean, because this is an off-year election.
You know, like I said last week, it's about making sure that we get the education out there, we get people excited about this election. But the excitement, unfortunately, is due to the unproductive government we currently have here in North Carolina. So we got to get people out to make the right decision and vote this regressive government out.
Well, we have that. Is that becoming? Have you seen any light where people are now saying, "Well, what the heck is going on here?" Has any of that starting to come out? Is any of that looking like it might come out?
Well, a lot of people are calling the Mecklenburg Democratic office and asking if they can get involved. And these are people who traditionally have never called by their own admission. So people are sick and tired. They know that they need to get out and galvanize. And I'm seeing a resurgence throughout Mecklenburg of people who have relocated here recently, as well as some older residents of Mecklenburg County. They want to get out, they want to support, and they want to work.
Now, you are running for District 92, am I correct?
That's correct, sir.
And that covers what area here in North Carolina, or in the Charlotte
area? That covers, in Mecklenburg County, it covers Lake Wylie up the west corridor, circling the airport to Lake Norman. So it's a very large district on the West Corridor.
And you have can only be described as I don't know what he could be described as, because he's not even aggressive. He's worse than aggressive. Now, I use the word aggressively in Republican, but he's worse than aggressive. I mean, this guy who currently holds the seat, really got to see through fraud and deception, because he hasn't done anything he said he was going to do. Am I correct?
You are very much correct. But the only thing that he does have for himself is the fact that he has the money from Alec. He has the money from the Koch brothers, Art Polk. You know, he has that support. And unfortunately, that does buy votes, that buy media. But I'm a grassroots campaigner. I've been around for over 12 years in Mecklenburg County. I don't walk away from the challenge. And at the end of the day, whether you're Republican or Democrat or in between, you can't continue to vote people in office who continue to vote against your interests.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, how did they frame this to make it a minority interest? How did they frame to say the ACA is only for African Americans and Hispanics. How did they, and for poor downtrodden women, how did they frame it where people bought that?
Well, you know, I mean, the Republicans from the top have great strategists who just work ever so hard to make sure that people do not understand what the issues are. And, you know, you have people who are Democrats who at one point are encouraged by voter suppression. And it was how it was delivered. Even Amendment 1, when they rolled out Amendment 1, it was more scare tactic of a homosexual type of overtone opposed to what Amendment 1 really meant across the board. So they have a great strategic team that are great wordsmiths who know how to frame it and create fear in people. And then people, once the fear is in there, then they're going to vote against their own interests and not even know it.
Well, you know, it's so fun because we got this guy, Governor Mike Pence, who is the governor of Indiana, and his whole thing, he's now who is against the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and against Obamacare. So he was against both of them. But now he says, you know, maybe we should be looking at all the dollars that are going to someplace else now to help his people, where he might have 125,000 people die this year because he didn't want to take money that wouldn't cost him a dime for 3 years. He wouldn't want to take money. But he says that he's going to create a limited health care Indiana plan, which looks just like the Affordable Care Act. Now, how do these guys explain to someone who's not 5 years old that this plan is no good, but this plan is the same plan? You know, it's almost like those guys that you saw with the hide the pee. Which cup is it under? It's not under any cup because you don't win.
It's a shell game. But you want to know something? Yeah, you want to know something? It's not about what's good for people. It's about the president, and it's about the president making this initiative. If this was done by anybody else, they would support it 100%. I mean, you know, let's take the state of Massachusetts and look at Romney. You know, I mean, he sold the state program out. So it's not about the program. It's about is the head of our country, you know, and that's what it, you know, reflects. Anything that President Obama wants to roll out, they show or try to make it, they vilify it. And that's what it is. I mean, a man was working out at a hotel, and it's talk about that. The man works with veterans, and there's nothing the man can do right. So affordable health care, we got to stop calling it Obamacare because that's all people hear. We have to call it what it is, affordable health care, and stay away from all the negativeness rhetoric that's out there.
Thomas, you have something to ask
Chairman?
You have something to ask Robin?
Oh, well, I actually, to tie it back in, I just wanted to hear her take. We opened the show talking about D-Day, and one of the points that we made in the conversation with Joe was concerning, like, forgotten generations, specifically Vietnam. I grew up with my uncles, my entire older family generation were all Vietnam vets, and they came back and were, you know, roundly dismissed and forgotten. And then, of course, Reagan went in and famously destroyed all of mental health care in America, so that we have had ever since then this shuffling population of abandoned and forgotten heroes out in the streets. You know, fend for yourself. Good luck. And I just wanted to hear her take on what we can do, because we're seeing it right now again that they are literally voting down any initiative, anything to help vets, to help the VA, to help our soldiers recover in any way, and to help expand health care in any way. So
what are we going to do to stop that, turn it around, and to call them on the carpet for it? Because they are getting away with disenfranchising an entire new generation of vets, just like what happened in my childhood.
Well, Bobby? You break up again.
You're absolutely right. It's cycles of disenfranchised and big chunks of communities being taken out, especially, you know, these veterans and things of that issue. But if we do not start educating the people about the issue, if we don't start voting the right type of people in to make the right decisions for that constituent base, we're always going to lose. You know, people, get up and vote. Stop sitting on your hands and stop being aggressive. We have to be pre-aggressive on these issues because we're going to have, it's not going to be a middle class. It's going to be the rich and the extremely poor. And we're going to have a civil war here in the United States if we continue to sit on our hands, not educate the people on the issue, and not vote.
Mr. Columnist, Mr. David Adams, what do you have? What is your first? If I know you're just a young man and you don't have any idea about the DJ, but what are your? What were your impressions, if any, on D-Day? About D-Day?
Well, you know, both of my father's brothers. My dad didn't serve in the Vietnam War. But his brothers served in Vietnam. One was a Special Forces Green Beret, and then also one was. I heard the gentleman talking about the medics. My oldest uncle, actually surviving uncle from my dad, was actually a medic in Vietnam. That war, just like the D-Day war, is one of the things that you talked about earlier, Michael, where you had a volume of people that were killed on the first day, 12,000, and now when you look at the conflicts that our country are involved in now, you got more people that are surviving, and you made a very perfect argument that since we're realizing that we got more people coming back that are going to be amputees or severely injured, it seems to me that our government should make the necessary arrangements that we have the appropriate medical facilities to be able to facilitate this level of veterans who come back from foreign wars, But it's just not the war situation or the combats and the thing with the government in terms of health care with the Veterans Affairs Administration. Like Robin was saying earlier, everything has been blamed on Obamacare. And if I'm not correct, it wasn't Obamacare, and she said not to call it Obamacare. I'll call it what it's supposed to be, the Affordable Health Care Act. Okay, wasn't North Carolina's premise for wanting to secede from the union was because of the Affordable Health Care Act?
Oh, absolutely.
That was my impression.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're right. And you know what? It's so funny because the gentleman who I'm running against, he was set on the town board of Huntersville, and he actually tried to get the town of Huntersville to secede from the state if the Republicans didn't win the mayor seat due to affordable health care. This is how small-minded people are.
Well, I'm sitting here with the chair of the party. There's about 500,000 people that might die if they don't get the Affordable Care Act instituted. Yeah. 500,000
right.
Affect that die.
But we'll have 50 more investigations of Benghazi, but 500,000, whatever.
That's more important. That's absolutely true. Madam Chair, how far are you away?
It says 75 miles away.
75 miles away? Okay. Well, that's all right. What else do you want if you are elected to get to seat 92? What do you want to be involved with? What committee?
Well, my first point of action is to look at why the state is so resistant to pay the educators. I want to also repeal voter suppression. I want to also repeal the war on women. I have a laundry list. And if I'm the only Democrat standing out there saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, you're going to hear my voice. Because this is crazy. I moved to a state. I'm from New York. I moved to a state that I thought we can truly retire in. And it's scaring me that the government is so closed-minded and so regressive that we might have to leave. And I don't want to leave. I've been here 13 years. You know, so I want to make sure that our educators are being paid accordingly. Because if these kids aren't educated, then we're going to have a massive problem. You know,
right.
People will learn about this trivial stuff. If children aren't educated, what are they going to do? See, they're going to prey on the Joe Citizen. So beware of what you're doing, North Carolina, regressive government headed by the Republicans.
Robin, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but I just read an article today that the University of Southern California has just recently done a study that voter suppression is becoming widespread across the nation. It's not just solely indigenous to North Carolina. I didn't know if you were aware of that or not.
No, I'm aware of it, but since the question was posed, what would I do when I'm elected for North Carolina, that's the first thing. And North Carolina was a petri dish for the movement of voter suppression. And you see, people need to understand that once these laws are enacted, then it's going to disfranchise major sections of the community in voting. And we will never, ever be able to recoup that back if we don't stop it now. And more people should be upset about this. You know, they're worried about other things out of the country. Let's focus on what's wrong in America. Let's focus on how to make those things right and expose the injustices for what they are. Stop focusing out of America. Focus what's going on, because we're going down the toilet if we continue to vote these people in.
Well, but didn't they just pass the assembly just pass a law here that the Moral Monday people couldn't congregate on the lawn? Is that right, Mr. Chair?
They did modify.
They modified the rules. So what do you think? So the thing is now, if you get up there and say that, they'll pass a law that you can't stand up and speak and say.
I can stand up and speak and be recognized at a General Assembly floor as a General Assembly member. You know,
not if they don't. Not if the chair doesn't let you be recognized. I mean,
well,
remember,
I'll be recognized. Put it this way: I'll be recognized the first time. The second time, probably not. But there's ways. I mean, social media exposure. We have to use everything that they've used plus to expose bad government. You know,
yes.
I'm not going to sit on my hands. I'm not going to be silent. And if I have to get arrested because of that, then I'll get arrested. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to sit there and not say anything. Wrong is wrong.
Well, joining us right now is the chair of the Democratic Party in the state of North Carolina, Mr. Randy Bowler. Have you been arrested yet? You haven't been arrested?
No, I have not.
You have to rest. I can hear you. Maybe you should be.
Are we plugged in?
You're plugged in. You're plugged in. Yes. Thomas, can you hear the chairman talking?
I can, yes.
What's that, Thomas? Thomas?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear Chairman Bowler?
I heard him when he answered the first time, but...
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Well, so you haven't been arrested yet?
No, I have not been arrested.
He says he hasn't been arrested, and he's looking forward to that.
That's right.
So, what happened at? Were you were at Moral Mondays when? That was.
I've been at almost every Moral Monday since the very beginning, when about 30 people marched by fire.
Right. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is the. I am not hearing you so much. Maybe this is just. Oh, maybe that's probably just an UMB. All right, go ahead and talk. Yeah. Okay.
I'm right here.
Yeah, okay, now I got you. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is this fracking. What the heck is this all about here? I mean, I'm looking at a have you seen this before?
Yeah, I helped produce that.
You
if you go online and look at the record in 2010, after a friend of mine who had previewed Gasland brought me to see it before it was sent out for distribution.
Is that right?
I went to see it at his house, and I went online and said I was ashamed to live in America where people were actually being exposed to this and not knowing what's being put in their water. If you watch that and think about what's going on, it gives you great pause.
Well, I'm looking. I can't believe it, Thomas. When I didn't have it, I couldn't send this to you. I was trying to send this to you last night so you would have it before the show. I don't know if you ever got the email. Did you get this email that I sent you? But
yeah, no, sir.
Okay.
Fracking didn't get it.
I would be happy to send it to you, Thomas. Basically, one of them is a diagram of the Triassic Basin showing kind of the depths here, the geologic formations, and, you know, kind of the ins and outs of hydraulic fracturing in our area. And, and the other one is actually a map, kind of if you're looking down on it, showing where you could frack, and it goes right over Jordan Lake. So the issue is the lake serves about 300,000 people for water in the western wake, center of the triangle. You'd want to really consider hydraulic fracturing in our area greatly before you put at risk the potential water supply for a great number of citizens in the triangle, not to mention the fact that there's a fault line there, the Jonesboro fault line that's near Sharon Harris, but you wouldn't want to get a frack quake right next to a large nuclear plant. I mean, Corey really needs to have his head examined for signing this into law for North Carolina. I'm not talking about fracking in the rest of the country. I'm just focused on fracking in our state and why it's something that needs to take great caution before you agree on it.
I mean, you're talking
great caution and worrying about public health when this is the same governor who was helping cover up, you know, the Dan River spills and ash, you know, they're pumping illegally everywhere until, you know, some activist flies over and films it. It's been going on. It's been going on. And we know it's been going on. And it's only until they're exposed that they even mumble around on TV and pretend to do something. But they don't care. It's all about the money. They don't care if it's on a fault line or sitting in our freshwater sources or anything else. The evidence is quite clear how dangerous and how deadly it is, which is exactly why they passed that thing, you know, a gag order. You can't even talk about fracking in the state.
Well, let me ask you this question, Thomas and Michael. I spoke yesterday in Winston-Salem to the senior Democrats, and I asked them this question. I said, I was raised with women. I mean, I was the oldest son. And if my sister was at a party and somebody came up to them and had a glass and said, I want to offer you this to drink, and she said, what's in it? And they said, well, that's proprietary. I can't tell you, but go ahead and drink it. And she bounced the glass off its tray. But they're asking you to accept that
right.
pumped into the
right.
you know, the groundwater potentially without telling us, because of the Halliburton exception, what's the components in the fluid. It seems a reasonable request. Second issue, I mean, McCrory was the mayor of Charlotte. When Charlotte's producing water for the citizens of Charlotte, you're required to tell people about the quality of your water. And if you actually produce water that has THMs or other problems that could cause cancer, you're supposed to send out a notice. So when we produce water, which you need for life, you have to tell people about what's in the water. But if I'm going to frack something with over 500 potential chemicals in it, I don't have to say what it is. That makes no sense at all.
And where do they get the water used for fracking? Isn't it going to be from that lake, those lakes, the underground stream?
The water is going to come from a variety of sources, but the big question is, in drought conditions, how would we be able to even supply the amount of
water they need?
The other issue about it is, if a wastewater treatment plant does not know the chemical composition of the fracking fluid when they produce the gray water that you see in those lagoons, you can't actually recycle it back to the system because nobody could potentially treat it and discharge it. The entire thing
right.
is a catch.
And we're catching without a catcher's mitt.
Yeah.
And it's Bob.
Well, again, even if it were the safest chemicals in the world and it was just pure water and all this stuff, nobody, that wasn't the issue. The issue is that they are blowing up shale because, you know, this whole thing of we're extracting from the rock. What they're doing is pulverizing the rock to get the liquid, you know, gas out of it so that they can use it. You can't blow something up without creating damage, without creating tremors, without creating faults and subterranean falls and collapses. That's what we have seen all over the whole nation, anywhere there's right. fracking. And besides the fact of the poisons that they're pumping in, it's the fracking process itself. You know, it by itself is inordinately dangerous. I just don't understand why we're even having that argument. It's like saying, you know, dynamite's not really bad when it blows up because the chemicals are unknown. What?
I think you make excellent points. I mean, even if you were to consider that the process was 100% safe, all of the ancillary processes to it, for instance, the trucks going to and from the site, require a great amount of public investment, which are external costs that industries don't like to bear. Mm-hmm. So widening roads, putting on thicker asphalt, all the things you see in areas that do this. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I would like to say, the meme that I think people need to pick up is this, and this is a letter to the editor that I put out that's getting published now. I feel that our governor has basically waved the white flag and surrendered our waters, our waterways, our farmland, our beaches, and our mountains to a rapacious industry that's very secretive. And if he hasn't surrendered, then he and the General Assembly have been willing dupes. He's either been duped into this deal, or he basically said, you know what, you know, we're open for business here, and I'm going to give you our coast. Because the next thing that's coming is offshore drilling.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, but see, no, he has not waved the white flag. He was the Manchurian candidate sent up here by Duke Power. So this was their plan.
Yeah, I mean, he's a lifelong employee.
I say he's on 28 years.
He waved the green flag. Go ahead and get started.
That's right. He says, open house now.
You know, rev your engines. Go.
He surrendered our state.
Absolutely. He surrendered the state. Our Pope is actually the governor. This man has surrendered his state and said, look, do what you got to do. Just don't bring me into picture.
Can you actually give me a clear example, and I would love to have a John Locke Foundation guy on here, where our governor has actually stood up for the public and actually shown a backbone and did not, in fact, surrender and give in. I mean, I don't mind making deals. I mean, being pragmatic is the nature
right.
of how you can get things accomplished.
Right.
But don't confuse being, you know, surrendering to being pragmatic. Show
right.
me a case where the man has not given in. Obama's constantly attacked about this stuff before he ever even started to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the negotiation here?
I mean, it's incredible that we could go from the third most educated state in the country to, I'm sorry, Thomas, below Mississippi in 6 months. How is that even possible? Was the money stolen? What happened?
Hey, Mike. Yeah, finally, a good day for Mississippi. Woo!
Hey, Mississippi. Any day you wake up on this side of the grass in Mississippi, it's a good day.
Here's another question I would like for you guys to ask. This. How come when Republicans have major gaping budget gaps, everybody gives you kind of the sheepish dog ate my homework excuse, but whenever there's somebody who's on public assistance or somebody on unemployment or anything, it's a major ordeal. Or when you're talking about Benghazi, all they do is focus on it. I'm going to give you an example. A couple weeks ago we heard a $445 million, give or take, bust from last year's fiscal year budget. And they came out shrugged, even though they were told that trickle-down doesn't work and refusing to extend the one-penny sales tax that they let go ahead and hit the sunset was going to do this. Then they come around a couple days ago and tried some shady three-card money maneuver with the federal government, with DHHS saying, we're going to charge $20 million and we're going to get a $60 million grant. And they thought they were going to get clever. And now we have a $60 million hole in this year's budget because they can't go and levy this tax on these 10 assisted living facilities that work, you know, are there for particular demographic groups.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they were told they didn't have it. Art Pope just comes and says, oh, well, DHS said we might have it. You know, that's the dog ate my homework excuse. They didn't have it nailed down, and now we're $60 million in the hole.
Yeah. You're saying they didn't have it nailed down. That sort of suggests that they weren't really sure. Did they do this on purpose?
I don't think so.
Of course they did.
If you read the Charlotte Observer today, it says that the governor was claiming how brilliant Aldana Voss was, probably because she assured him that her little maneuver here was going to work. But she's not that brilliant. Because
you think?
Here's the thing. You can't attack the federal government, refuse to accept assistance, and then come back later hat in hand and
say,
hey, I want to work with you now.
Right. It's too late. The money is gone. It's been given to somebody else. Absolutely.
They're not going to approve this maneuver. But my point is, whenever there's someone out there that costs the system a few shekels, they are screaming. But I've just given you over $500 million in budget busts, and people are yawning. Oh, I guess it's acceptable. I thought.
Yeah.
Well, Pope.
How's that flat tax working out now?
Yeah, exactly.
It puts us flat on our ass.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But look, this is the thing, Mike. They just, 2 days ago or whatever, they just gutted Common Core, and one of the stated reasons was that they want to get North Carolina out from under federal control because the big government come in here and tell us what to do. I mean, again, they had every opportunity try to secede. And then at the same time, turn around with their hat in their hand, saying, where's my money?
Well, that's right. How do they expect to get money for these schools if they're not going to take Common Core? I mean.
Well, right. I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous.
It's 646-716-5242. David, you're in the... Well, you're up in rich country, Connecticut.
In rich country, listen.
Hey,
that's Michael's term for anywhere north of south.
you're in Connecticut, or were you outside of Connecticut?
No, I'm actually in the state of Connecticut, Michael.
Okay, so, does Mary know that? Oh, well, that's a little joke. Okay.
Oh, my God. Don't talk about – please don't talk about Mary.
The thing is that the governor of Connecticut is who now? I can't remember.
His name is Daniel Malloy. Daniel Malloy.
Okay, Malloy, okay. Now, he's a Democrat, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He's a Democrat.
Okay. Now, do you guys – have a hole in your budget? Has it come out? Are you short? Are you over? Are you halfway there? You know, level?
No, actually, they have a surplus as far as the educational system here. You know, my significant other is a school teacher. Connecticut teachers are the highest paid in the country. And this Common Core issue, just ludicrous. You guys are going to lose millions of dollars to pull out of Common Core.
Being from Connecticut, you know, the rich
and
part
plus,
of the country.
Besides the fact they don't have any idea of what they're going to put in its place. You know?
Well, hey, nothing, because our
exactly. We only need one book.
And see, this is the thing that Robin was talking about, Thomas. You know, all these programs and stuff, you know, they have an issue with every program. You know, they want to pull out of every program, or they want to attack every program, and this has nothing to do with the particulars of each program itself. Now, Bush gave us this, what is it, No Child Left Behind? What a disaster that was. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so, you know, I just don't understand, you know, they're complaining about every program, and it all points back to a black man being the first person seated of color seated in the White House. And that's all it is.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
You're right, Thomas. I mean, you're so right. You're so right about that. They don't want another one in. And if you educate them, they all will come and will flood the gate. But Thomas, to answer your question, what are they going to replace with Common Core?
Nothing.
No, they already have. Chartered schools.
True. That's absolutely true.
Right, so
charter schools.
And the charter schools, and then we can get only certain people going to those charter schools, and the rest of you people that can't get on a bus or can't get transportation will have to not learn those broken down public schools.
Hey,
what a coincidence, Mike. They also canceled busing.
But then even if you can get there, you might be put on a waiting list.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. You put on the waiting list. Oh, yeah, it'd be the waiting list like the VA has.
Exactly.
you'll never get called up.
Your child's been on that waiting list since the third grade. And if you don't homeschool them, by the time they're supposed to go to the fifth grade, they'll only be ready to go to the third grade because they were miseducated for 2 years.
This is how, and that's why, do you actually think this was just accidental that they came from Texas to come here to raid our teachers? Because they told the teachers, hey, look, we don't teach jack down here, and we got a lot of money. You can have days off every, you know, they probably only have one or two classes a day. So those people out of Texas, I mean, hey, if you're over 50, you're all right. But if you're under 50, you don't know jack. And those people down there, they're raiding the schools up here. They want to get all these teachers down there. Hey, we're going to give you a lot more money than give you in North Carolina. Come teach our first graders nothing. Come teach our
But wait a minute, Michael. Aren't they succeeding from the union as well?
it's a bigger plan, because the history books, the books that are throughout the nation for education are written and created in Texas.
Right. What a coincidence. That is the answer right there to David's question. They are seceding, but just like Jesus and the other disciples, it takes a long time when you're actually riding on the dinosaur. it's taking them a while to get out of the union, you know.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Because the dinosaur, you know, he's got to eat a lot of food in order to stay that big. So he's got to stop every five minutes.
It's just embarrassing. It's horrifying. But I can't believe it's happening to our state. You know, it's bad enough when we sit here and make fun of Mississippi or Texas and all. But, you know, again, it was happening to them over there. So let's not really do anything here. And then now, just like a nightmare in World War II, they're on our doorsteps. They've come for us.
Just right. Just like World War II. They came for my neighbor. You know, I didn't help them.
Yeah, and that's what these midtermers did. Hey, they came for the neighbors, but nobody showed up to vote. You know, who cares?
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And as I say all the time, when you're out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and a great white shark comes by and bites you in the waist and takes all your legs off, why is everybody now want to go out and hunt that shark? That's not the shark's fault. Your butt should have stayed out of the damn ocean. I mean, that's, you know, If you're going to the zoo and you stick your hand in the lion's cage and he tears it off, what, are you going to shoot the lion now?
Yes, because he beat you. But you want to know something? Watch the movie Purge, because America is starting to look like that. One day out of the year, the elitists are going to come through and take away the small guy, and it's going to be legal. So get ready, people. Just sit around and watch.
Well,
it's kind of frightening. What Robin is saying, it's very true. It's frightening. Because if you look at everything about our country right now, from the nonpartisanship with the House and the Senate, you know, and then all the bills that they have just put a complete roadblock in front of for this particular president. I mean, they are dragging this country into the mud. And I mean, like Robin is saying, I guess we can't fall any further than just total anarchy in the streets, a civil war. Well, I mean, we are just that divided.
Well, you know, and the thing that makes it worse, you know, I talked about my wife who works at the VA, and she said some of these Vietnam vets come in, and even the other vets, but most of the Vietnam vets, they'll come in for a 1 o'clock appointment at 10 or 11 o'clock. And then they keep coming up to the table. Where's the doctor at? When am I going to be seen? He said, wait a minute. He comes out, and they look at the at your time. What time are you supposed to be here, sir? 1 o'clock. He says, but it's only 10:30 now. Why are you here? Well, I wanted to come early so I could get out early. I mean, come on. Give me a freaking break. The problem is, though, we have made them like that. Because a lot of these guys, most of these guys, were only, as Joe said, were just let in to the Vietnam, the VA circle by General Shinseki. Half these people that we're seeing now, not half, but I say a third of them, weren't getting any treatment since Vietnam.
Yeah. They've been ignored, been invisible.
Okay, this now. Putting this back to where we are right now, we have people all across the country, Appalachia, you know, but we got people in the main cities, Charlotte, New York, who aren't getting as the treatment that they deserve. Now, not New York as much, but Charlotte and the southern states are a lot. The people are not getting nothing because their government says, we don't want a government. You don't need a government. It's everybody for themselves. A government is a distraction. A government is steals. Meanwhile, if you give me about $100, I'll see what I can do.
Right.
But Michael, you know, to the government's credit, though, a lot of that is not necessarily rest on the doorstep of our federal government, because a lot of these directors at these VA facilities, I don't know if people are aware of the bonuses that they get. Okay,
absolutely.
The books are being cooked, you know,
absolutely.
And you know they got secret lists, and the books are being cooked to make the numbers look a certain way, so that they benefit from it financially. You know, they don't care anything about the veterans.
You see, and it's not the doctors, it's the administrators, and some of these administrators, of course, they're appointed by whoever the president was. And we have a lot of George Bush administrators in the VA. And you know, and I'll tell you a short story. When I was working with federal government, I was the head of the EEO for for the National Weather Service, for the part of the Weather Service that I was involved with. And the section, the eastern section. And I was only there I was head of EEO maybe for about 8 months, and all of a sudden we got a new director. You know who the director was? I think I might have told you this, Thomas. Our Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas.
Oh, God.
Y'all had quality, quality at the helm.
Don't talk bad about Clarence Thomas. He's just a misguided Negro.
Listen to him. Oh, my God.
The VA
Thomas.
that the CEO had complaints. I mean, that's where you go for your complaints. He had about 15,000 complaints. They were behind. Clarence Thomas came in, and in 2 years, there was no complaint. Because you know what happens after, I think it's 15 months, your complaint automatically goes off the books if it's not heard. So he just didn't hear any books. He didn't hear any complaints, and they went off the books. And he got
no complaints in a shredder, Mike. What are you talking about?
Hey, that's it. Well, the thing was that he never took care. He took care of maybe a fourth of them. But the rest of them went in the goodbye file, that shred file, just by not doing anything. And that's why he was put in charge. He said he was going to go in there and straighten out the EEO, and he did. So, you know, we have the same people.
Yeah, but the thing is, Mike, this whole thing, the VA scandals, the everything else, it's gone. You know, unfortunately, now it's tainted Obama as well, but the VA scandals, long-running, just like that factoid I sent you the other day where it says more of our American citizens here at home are dying in, like, this state alone per hour than died in Benghazi just because we're blocking Medicaid expansion. You know, all of these types of problems, everything down the line is due to just continually shrinking and cutting and cutting and shrinking and drowning that baby in the tub for every budget, for every department.
Yep,
and
every department.
There's less money, so there's less services, and it's simple mathematics. There's no nefarious plan or whatever, but you cannot run two wars for 10 years and then have no increases, no new hospitals, no new staffs, no dramatic increase in services across the board, and expect to treat these people. It can't happen. It's impossible.
Well, Thomas, somebody's getting care. Who are these people that are getting the treatment? Who are the people that are getting the care?
I think there's just a small fraction of people because they simply can't handle the numbers because there's no – I mean, look, they're blocking the budget even this month. They blocked it again to build those new hospitals. There's no budget. There's no doctors. There's nothing. So all you got is a couple of bureaucrats sitting around shuffling papers. And a few people, you know, accidentally get treated. But the rest of them suffer. That's what's happening in this country across the board.
Accidentally get treated.
A lot of these doctors, like where my wife works at the clinic, they are hired part-time. Part-time doctors working at the clinic who are private doctors who are used to working in a private practice, not under federal practice where every single thing you do has to be dotted and crossed, the T has to be crossed, everything, you got to make double, triple paperwork and stuff. They don't do that in private practice. And she says the doctors complain all the time, oh, this is too much paperwork. Why can't we just, I don't want to do that. So the nurses have to do it. But so the thing is that because we don't want to hire the doctors and the nurses to be federal workers, the whole thing is they don't want state workers, they don't want city workers, they don't want federal workers. They want nobody. They wanted to go back to 1700s when it was just, you know, Pony Express and, you know.
Well, no, Mike, you're even saying it what it is, the part-timers. It's just like they do in industry, in retail stores.
They'll cost this whole country. That's a exploit the loophole. If you have 55,000 part-time workers, nobody has to get paid full benefits.
Well, that's right. And you're blanking out. Can't hear you. Thomas. I lost you, Thomas. Bless you. Well, but this is correct, right, Jim?
I think that the blame needs to go all the way back to the beginning of what got us into the war in the first place, when Bush's people said this war would pay for itself, which it didn't. And then, because of technology, people that used to die of wounds in the war are living with horrific injuries. I don't know if you heard any of that.
Yes, yeah, I heard.
And their lives have been shattered, and essentially the government, you know, is not paying paying their side of the contract. I mean, what's amazing about a political party that wraps itself in the flag for the first time to pay for the bill, I've never seen. My grandfather used to call his folks, they have alligator arms and go out to eat because when it comes to the local, they go to the bathroom. What they're doing to veterans. Out on the check. And they're
How convenient.
I mean, the problem with the American people is that we don't honor history and we don't want to pay attention to how we got here, so we instantaneously blame the people that are there now. So, I mean, Obama takes an awful lot of the blame because he's in charge, but it wouldn't matter if Obama was there or Michael Lawson was the president.
No.
You know, this was prefigured over a decade ago, when those decisions were made to go to war, a war that cost trillions of dollars, that everyone told them you're going to have wounded warriors coming back that are going to have a lifetime of treatment, and they kind of shrugged.
I think Shinseki said that, didn't he?
They all told them that. They know this. And my father was a vet. My father was, you know, and he was a Vietnam vet, and he was an officer, so he had gold-plated insurance coverage, and he fought hard for vets up until when he died. But I can tell you this, that there was even an unequal care amongst the vets, and that's exactly what you're seeing here. It's not, you know, it's not right, it's not fair, and it's unjust, but unfortunately that's become the mantra of our country.
Right, absolutely. Now, we have a, let's see, Thomas, what happened to you? Okay. All right, Thomas, you back with us now?
I am indeed
Thomas.
Back.
Okay.
Every once in a while I get so heated that, you know, the NSA steps right in and just deletes my call. So sorry about that.
Oh, wait a minute. Are you related to Mary, Thomas?
Yeah. Well, I have to tell him about Mary. I don't think he quite knows Mary yet. So, hey, if you never call, listen. The cyber command is on to you. I want to tell you that right now. But because he already thinks cyber command is on to you. But what realistically, no. And as a Vietnam vet myself, and I was not wounded in Da Nang, and I was, as a matter of fact, I was directed by my bodyguard that I don't fire a weapon unless they run over the base and kill me three times. I said, that's all right with me. But the thing is that there are a lot of vets. There are a lot of vets. Now, my wife says that she sees now who were never, ever given the up. They were turned down to even go to the VA. Turned down. And now, then they got a letter last year. Hey, come. Let's see what's wrong with you. So General Shinseki did a lot of changes, just like Joe said. There are a lot of changes, but we, as we say before, you had people dying during World War One who got shot in the finger. You have people, then he goes to World War Two, and you got people who get shot in the helmet and don't die. They get shot in the finger, they don't die. They get shot in the leg, and they don't die. Then now you go to Vietnam, you're shot 45 times and you don't die. Why? Because the medical treatment has superior, has grown since 1900. But the hospitals are still in 1950. We don't have the doctors. They don't want to pay for the doctors because they don't want to pay for their retirement. We don't have the doctors and nurses because they don't want to put in a 401k. This is the reason. They don't like government. Well, why do you go work for government? Because I want to kill government. You know, yeah, but then you want to take the pension that goes along with it. I mean, come on. Is something wrong with this picture? There's something really is wrong with this picture. So,
it's all about the money, though.
It's all about the money. It's absolutely true. It's all about the money. Now, David, you have been furiously involved in another subject that you have been deeply involved in. Can you fill us in on where we're at with this?
Yeah, well, as I told you on yesterday, Michael, I woke up to a news article that was published down in Franklin County down in Lewisburg, Franklin Times, where the journalist by the name of Kerry Johnson wrote an article basically depicting the culmination of Shannon Amodi's case, where he actually went into court and allegedly pled and accepted a deal for roughly 10 years in prison for conspiracy to commit murder. And, you know, the gentleman, I was very concerned that his article basically was filled with a lot of hot air. The gentleman didn't support any of his facts. He just basically wrote what people said. I was very concerned about that. I contacted him personally and spoke with him regarding that article. And I questioned him, you know, about some of the things that he said. And I asked him, have you ever seen any of the evidence in this case? And he spoke to me, he answered me in the affirmative, in the negative, no, you know, that he had never seen it. And so I was concerned as to why he would write it then, you know. But that case, that story with that young man is a very tragic story. He was actually scheduled to go, he was in the delayed entry program. He was scheduled to enlist in the United States Marine Corps in September. And unfortunately, in August, he was charged with a very, very brutal crime. All of the evidence in the case, we've been over it. You, Thomas, and I and various other guests have been over this over and over again about how weak, you know, the prosecutor's case was against this young man. But somehow they were able to treat him harshly enough to convince him to take the deal. So it's just a very, very disturbing story. And at this point, you know, barring an act from God, this young man is probably going to go into jail for going to prison for 10 years, Michael.
Well, you know, this is what you have been coming up with, but I just don't feel that way. I think that when someone reviews this case and looks at what the judge did and looks at what the lawyer did and looks at that there's no evidence whatsoever, that he was even involved, and that the lawyer was paid by his aunt to keep him in prison, there's going to be a lot of things and a lot of people who are going to be in deep trouble. A lot of people who are going to be in deep trouble.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, from the court system aspect of it, Michael, when the defendant in North Carolina pleads guilty to a felony crime, their recourse as far as any type of appeal are very limited. Okay, so I don't know what can be could be done for this kid, other than some act or intervention from the governor of the state of North Carolina himself.
Right, because one of the problems with this is not that he was found guilty in a trial or something like that, but that he pled. He himself has pled guilty now.
Well, the problem is, one, you got to convince me that that's his signature. You got to convince me that he wasn't told anything else, and you got to convince me that this judge who flew up to Franklin County from Raleigh on an administrative day and held an administrative court hearing, or was this a trial? Administrative court hearing on a day that he's supposed to be in his office doing administrative work doesn't sound legal to me.
Nothing that's happened in this court sounds legal.
Hold on 1 minute. We got another guest going in. Hello, guest. Who's this?
Yes, this is Dr. Benjamin Chavis.
Dr. Chavis, how are you, sir? I thought I'd see you up here by now. Where are you at?
Well, I've just landed at the Raleigh-Durham Airport. I'm on my way.
You're on your way. Is anybody coming to get you?
Yeah, I'm in the car now.
Oh, you're in the car, right? Oh, okay, good. Okay. Well, we have been talking about the just recently. We were talking about D-Day at the beginning of the show. What are your memories that you can remember about family or personal relatives about D-Day?
Well, it was a very important day. My father was a veteran of World War One, and of course, by the time D-Day happened, anyone who fought in World War One was also concerned about World War Two. So the thing is, I think a lot of times now in 2014, as people look back on the wars that America's been involved in, there's a tendency to take for granted all of the sacrifice, all of the tremendous giving on the part of many persons who we don't even know their names, don't know their faces. But if it was not for their sacrifice, we would not have democracy as it is today. So this is a very important day. I thought President Obama was well-received today. I don't know if you saw the program. Of all the world leaders, he got a standing ovation. He was, and it wasn't just a clap for President Obama. It was a clap for all of America.
Right. Absolutely correct. Well, people don't realize that it was a dig. I had my daughter, youngest daughter, call me up today. She was watching this film called Emperor. And it was Tommy Lee Jones was playing General MacArthur, where he came into Japan. And the thing was about the Emperor of Japan was still there, but the actual Emperor was actually MacArthur. And the thing that MacArthur did that wasn't done in World War One, well, they go back to World War One. World War One, the president at the time, Woodrow Wilson, went to I believe it was France or England, and basically brought his 14 points with him. That was going to make this the last war we ever had. But the French and the English and the other countries, the other allied countries were so upset with what went on at Germany, they wanted to punish Germany, that Germany would never, ever, ever do anything ever again in life. And what they did was they took every single thing they could from them. And they also charged them $80 billion in reparations, which today is equivalent to about $4 trillion. And people don't know, was just paid off by the Germans in 2009. So this led all these reparations that Germany had to pay lived in the children of the parents from World War One, and Hitler was one of the people. And it resulted in World War Two. And this is what MacArthur did in Japan. He decided this was never going to happen again with Japan. And he let the emperor stay and have the power that he always had. He also gave reparations to every single person in Japan. He let them get back their dignity. So we're in a situation right now where, is the Republican Regressive Party, are they taking away the dignity of every single person in this country? Dr. Chavis? Hello, Ben? We lose you?
Yes, I'm with you. I'm with you. Well, again, history, you know, June 6th is also the day that Robert Kennedy was assassinated back in 1968. And June 6th is also the day that one of the major civil rights leaders was signed into law. So I think that as we reflect on D-Day, as we reflect on democracy, you know, the reason why I'm in Raleigh is to attend the North Carolina Democratic Convention. And I think that democracy is a participatory process. And today we celebrate all of the men and women who participated in the wars on behalf of democracy. And that is why today we should not allow anything or anybody to try to take away people's democratic rights that they died and hard fought for, particularly for African Americans. You know, our right to vote was not only fought for on the battlefields of foreign countries, but on the battlefields here in America.
Well, if you, I'd like to play some for you. I just want you to listen and get your thoughts on what this person says. Hold on just a minute.
Hello? How many of our Christians what I call the goo-goo syndrome? Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Dr. Chavis?
Yes.
What do you think of that? What do you think of that?
Well, you know, for what I'm here, the session was not that good, but I just think that, you know, different people have different views about voting, about democracy. But I think we all know that in the United States of America, what makes our country strong is this diversity. Is its inclusion, not its exclusion. And certainly here in North Carolina, we're at a testing point right now about whether or not we're going to permit all the good people in North Carolina to participate in the democracy, or whether or not we're going to have a situation where there's certain forces that try to exclude people from participating in democracy based on socioeconomic circumstance, based on race, or based on some other factor that it tends to exclude people. And I don't think you need a voter ID. You're born with your ID if you're a citizen of the United States, and no one should try to take a right away to vote.
Well, according to Paul Reinwirth, who we just heard, and this, he's the father of the conservative movement, he said this 20 years ago. So the idea is, they were trying to do this 20, 30 years ago, and it didn't matter if you were black, white, or purple, or you had, it only mattered whether you had money.
That's correct. That's correct. And so, you know, change, whether it's negative change or positive change, does not happen overnight. And so what we're living through in North Carolina just didn't happen. It's been built for a long time. And if we're going to reverse it, we also have to be committed to a protracted organization, consistent mobilization, and remind people of the price of liberty, the price of freedom. That's what D-Day, that's what the President of the United States tried to remind the whole world today. What is the price of liberty?
Right. Well, how long do you think it's going to take us to make this change? Because, as you said, it didn't happen overnight, but it happened, though, in this state almost overnight in 2010 when nobody came out and voted. I mean, that's what happened here. Nobody voted. And here we are.
Well, again, you know, if you don't exercise your right, you don't have the right. And so when there's a low voter turnout, when there's low expectations in terms of civic participation, this is what we wind up. There are 1 million more Democrats in North Carolina than there are Republicans. So why are the Republicans controlling the governor's house? Why are the Republicans controlling the state legislature? The Democrats have to look into the mirror. Instead of standing at the Republicans, Democrats better look in the mirror, roll up our sleeves, and get busy and take the state back from the hands of the ultra-conservatives.
Well, you weren't on yet when I gave the example that if you're sticking your hand in the lion's den and the lion bites it off, it's not the lion's fault.
Well, no question about it. But see, the thing is, you know, the lion, I think that's a good analogy. But, you know, people, there's a difference between being ignorant and knowing that if you stick your head in a lion's mouth, the lion will chop it off. But there is no excuse for not going out to vote. There is no excuse for not registering to vote. There is no excuse for not engaging in civic participation at the local level. There's no excuse for not going to the school board meeting. There's no excuse for not going to the city council meeting. There's no excuse for not being involved in the county commissioner. If you make those excuses, then you will stick your head in the line. your ignorance and after your do nothingness.
Well, you know, you're actually, you have
Amen.
Sex, but you, you know, you have children. I took my 5-year old son, a 5-year old grandson, to a friend's house. No, matter of fact, it was my friend. It was my pastor. He's my son. Pastor's office the other day. He has a big dog himself, a 70-pound dog. But he's got the pastor has his little dog. He has about 3 or 4 of them. And one of them was barking so loud, he did not even want to go in there. So he's 5 years old, and he knows when things are not right. How do you not know that something's going to go wrong if you don't get out and vote? I mean,
well, keep in mind, dear brother, your program is an exception. If you listen to talk radio in North Carolina, you don't hear what you're hearing right now. You know, you hear Rush Limbaugh, you hear the right wing has taken over the media. And there are very few progressive programs left on radio. You're one of the few. So, you know, when people act not in their own interests, it's not because they're asleep, it's because they've been misguided. They have been misinformed. And it is possible in 2014. It happened in 2010. It happened in 2011, when that was in 2014. And it will happen again in November if we don't wake people up. So we have to wake people up in the church, in the radio, in the party, in the elections, and because people will doze off and people will lose. A lot of people don't think about the sacrifice of the military to D-Day. I think that's ridiculous. I think that one of the reasons why we still have wars going on because people's memory of the devastation of war is too short. People do forget. And that is why you need activists. That's why you need organizers. That's why you need mobilizers that will keep people awake.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely correct. Mr. Hill, you got something to chime in on?
I've been listening to Ben, and I concur with what he's saying. It's true that the concentration of power in the media, especially corporate media, has pushed out a lot of voices. And I have been...
I'm glad we lost.
No, I'm still here. We have a lot of static. Hello?
Yeah, a lot of static, right. Go ahead. Go ahead.
But the bottom line is Ben is correct. What we're trying to do is combine democracy with a platform. What that means is that
I'm just a few blocks from Governor House. I think you get a lot of static on the radio. Sometimes you try to jam your program. I think, you know, I wouldn't put a bad ass the right wing to try to put a lot of static so people can't hear what you're saying.
Uh-oh, Dr. Ben's related to Murray, too.
We only have another 35 minutes,
hey, Mike, are you up in Franklin County?
You mean Guantanamo Bay, North? No, I'm not in Guantanamo Bay, North. I'd be probably doing one of those perk walks in a minute. But tell us something, David. What we're seeing, and you're not seeing this in Connecticut. Let me tell you, it's Ben Spohn that's doing all this stuff. Well, you're not seeing this in Connecticut. So what does it look like? What are people saying from Connecticut about, gee, what the heck is going on in Texas and North Carolina and these other places. What are they saying?
Well, you know, Connecticut is a lot different. You know, it's a very wealthy state. People here tend to be very, very laid back. It's a complacency, but it's not the kind of complacency that Robin is talking about and that Dr. Ben is talking about and Randy's talking about. It's a kind of complacency where, you know, I have my space, you have your space, and we'll leave it at that. You know, but I think the kind of things that, you know, Dr. Ben was just raising is people not exercising their right to vote and expressing the full extent of democracy in this country. You know, right. But I think a lot of that is attributed to the fact that people are so distrustful of our government, okay, because of some of the wars that we've had in the past two decades. Like President Bush said that this one country had weapons of mass destruction, and they didn't, when they went in there and came out, they didn't find so much as a water pistol there, okay? And then this whole thing in Afghanistan, what this war is supposed to be about, you know, it's just no justification. American people are tired of seeing their sons and daughters go into conflict in countries under the auspices that is for the defense of democracy, but in actuality, you know, the wars are predicated on big business from a very small percentage of our population who are profiting from it, you know, financially. So I think that the complacency is due to the distrust of the government and just the mindset that, you know, true democracy in this country doesn't exist and my vote doesn't count. So I think that's the real root of why we see so much complacency when people don't come out to the polls to vote.
Yeah, but you see, I the problem that I have with this is that you put the people in the seats of government, and you should be able to take them out. And complaining when you don't go to the poll why something happened is no good for me.
But on the other hand, Mike, on the other hand, you have to understand, people feel that they have arrived. People feel that they have gotten what they needed. They live better in some cases than their parents. And they don't see the value in voting. But for them to get to where they're at, they had to vote. People had to vote before them. So we have to bring people back to what matters. We have to educate people about the issue. And we have to do a good job about showing them, look, you're comfortable now? You're getting ready to lose everything. And if you value that, then get out and vote. And do your due diligence on the candidates that you're voting for.
There are a number of systemic reasons for why. Political parties are essentially drinking from the same economic ecological straw, the same drink. You're going to end up with scenarios where people think that you're all the same, and so there's no reason for me to get involved. That's the problem we have. Theory. Number two, I guess I'll go back to when I was raised in Catholic school, but if you're reading the Old Testament, the idea of free will, free will gives you the opportunity to make a choice. But to make the right choice, and I used to question whether that was free. And when we talk about fighting for democracy overseas, we only fight for democracy in the notion that they elect people we like. So it's a condition to free will. There's a caveat on the democracy. If they elect somebody like a Chavez, democratic somehow is a problem. And it goes back to that neoliberal orthodoxy. The problem is not with the people of America. The problem is that the very few that might not benefit by those people being in power. And if you look at what's happened post-World War II around the world, it all had to do with an expression of power. It was controlling the assets on the ground.
Mm.
You know?
Well, no, this is actually true. But, you know, you had, and that's what happened, the story I was telling about where Wilson brought the 14 points over there to Europe, and they chopped them all up. They weren't the 14 points that he brought over there, and that's what led to World War II. They took all everything. You know, and I would say before that the Germany just paid off that $80 billion debt in 2009.
The reparations.
They were just paid it off.
Don't you find it funny that they forced to pay reparations, but they refused to pay reparations for
I wonder why.
Germany was forced to pay them.
That's right. They were forced to pay them. That's right.
Okay.
And they paid it off in 2009.
So I'm just pointing out, people have problems with democracy when they see elements of cognitive dissonance within a system. Essentially, what's good for the douche should be good for the gander, but we should not universally apply that. Today, if we went back to the Nuremberg trials of 1946, you would find a lot of Americans within the power, like President Bush, that probably would be found guilty of principles
you think?
They pounded away at Nuremberg.
You think that, these guys can't leave the country? I mean, they'll go to Japan, but they're not going to Europe.
The idea that we would allow waterboarding and other forms of torture and say that this is just an extension of interrogation is absolutely
Of course it is. Of course. But I wouldn't know one soldier that would say that they'd like waterboarding, because it could be them.
Well, not only that, you know, what kind of intelligence did you actually get out of it? We all know that the sword on the wall is the bigger threat than the sword in the hand. Once you start doing that to somebody, they're going to say anything. And how valuable is the intelligence?
My father had a belt. And that was, I got it once. And that was enough. He had to show it. And, that was it for me. But on the other hand, my brother, if it was Tuesday, he was getting a beating. My father would say, is this today Tuesday? Dennis, come on, get a beating. I know you did something wrong. So he'd lie about it. So
I guess my original supposition.
Hello?
Hello? Hello?
I was wondering what happened.
I don't know. I guess did we lose the host?
I think we lost the host.
That's pretty funny. I do. I think we lost the host. That's fairly unique. So here's the question. Are we linked only by phones, or are we still linked on the air?
Let's say
I'm not actually sure.
Say something outrageous, Tom.
Oh, everything I say is outrageous. Come on, please. Well, here's a horrible factoid. Since David was talking about this, I just wanted to bring this up because I love to say this at every chance. Cheney's corporation during the war in Iraq made $40 billion.
Is that all?
I mean, That's a jaw dropper, but his one company. That's exactly why people don't believe in these wars or anything else that they're supposedly, you know, defending freedom around the world. I mean, come on.
Was that Halliburton?
The war.
I was going to say, look
Halliburton.
At Halliburton.
Yes. And see, here's the thing. You know, it's funny how we learned that he was like an executive for Halliburton, okay, after he got in office. We didn't know anything about that.
Right. That's just like when the last presidential election was going. You know, they had a hard time getting the Republican candidate to even turn over 12 months of income tax. You know,
exactly.
Everything Republican world is just a black box, and you just, you know, go with it.
I'm just
same rules do not apply.
I'm just here, just joined here at the party headquarters with Dr. Ben Chavis, live and in person.
Thank you.
Hey, you're back.
So, we went down for some reason, so I had to go up on Skype because everything went down here in the office. So I guess we got it.
Well, Thomas, I don't think it's NSA fooling with the mic. I think it's the Republican Party in North Carolina, because every time, you know, the Democratic chair, Mr. Voller, speaks, we seem to have these technical difficulties.
What a coincidence. No, didn't you know, hey, David, enough of your conspiracy theories. It's actually that he was speaking, he only speaks when he drives between towers. Come on.
Right. So, since I have you here, Dr. Chavis, tell us, because we were talking about when we got cut off, you were coming in here, that the reparations that we made the Germans pay from World War One was actually, and everything we took for them after World War One, destroying the 14 points that Wilson brought to them. They were so upset with the Germans, they wanted to bury them so they never, ever could do anything again. And that's what bred World War II. Now, they had to pay $80 billion worth of reparations, and Germany just paid off the reparations in 2009. What is happening in this country that might cause the same thing? We have people here in this country, and, you know, right now we thought it was just us, but everybody's being affected. And as I told one person, you know, some of these people are dead and they don't even know it yet.
Well, thank you. But I, you know, at my age, I cannot afford to be a pessimist. I'm optimistic. And the reason why I'm optimistic is because I think that the forces of repression, the forces of backwardness, the anti-democratic forces are losing ground. They just came out with the unemployment report. The economy is rebounding. They won't give the Democratic president credit for the rebounding of the economy. But the truth of the matter is, I believe that by 2016, and it's going to start this year in 2014, I think the Democratic Party not only has an opportunity but an obligation to restore stronger democracy. You know, reparations is just not a to answer the question, it's just not a financial matter. It's a state of the mind.
Yeah.
How do you repair consciousness after a long period of suffering? I know here in North Carolina, one of the reasons why the Moral Monday movement has grown exponentially is because people are fed up. Their cups are run over.
Right.
And I think that you know, a Republican mayor just came out and joined.
Absolutely. So
the Moral Monday movement and took exception to the people in his party, the Republican Party, that are hurting the people in his town.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're going to see a lot of Republican officials not only speak out, but I think that they're going to begin to articulate the interests of the people that they're supposed to represent. And so I think that the pendulum of time, the pendulum of politics is moving, is trending in the direction of the Democrats. However, I do not hope that any Democrat or even somebody listening to the radio program or independent would relax, because the pendulum is trending now back in a more progressive way. It means that we have more opportunities and more responsibilities. It's not going to happen overnight.
Well, yeah, but don't you feel that the election of President Obama, the first black president of the United States, when he was elected, everybody said, oh, my gosh, there's going to be a chicken in every pot now. Did you think they had that syndrome? They said, we don't need a vote anymore. Everything's going to be taken care of.
No, I think that – I don't think everybody thought that, but I do
– A lot of people.
I think some people thought that, but keep in mind, there was no Tea Party before Obama was elected. So there were some people who said, I don't want a chicken in anybody's pot.
Yeah.
And that's right. How the Tea Party
Yes. Right.
Because they don't believe that the government should be
right.
providing opportunity to anybody.
That's correct.
And so it's a reaction. You know, the law of physics, you know, once there's an action, there's a reaction. And the Tea Party since 2008 is a reaction to the election of President Barack Obama. And North Carolina went in favor of Obama in 2008. What happened in 2012? There was a reaction.
2010.
Right, in 2010, but I'm talking in terms of the national ticket.
Yeah.
And even though the National Democratic Convention was in North Carolina, That was not enough in and of itself to hold North Carolina as a blue state. And but I do believe that all of what we're witnessing, and that is why I think the Democratic Convention here in Raleigh tomorrow is going to be a vibrant, up-paced convention. And I think to Randy Baller's credit, as chairman of the party, he had a lot of internal things he had to fight off.
Are you kidding?
You know, so
he's still alive. I don't know how that happened.
He's still alive. And so you know, I have guarded optimism.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of work to do now between now and November. I was so pleased. I thought the candidacy and the re-election of Robin Hudson to the state Supreme Court
was
a good indication of what's possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that...
so we got to get Judge Beasley in.
Exactly. Right. Well, I said all these things we have to work on. We have to work on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Hudson is still on the ballot. She wasn't reelected. Robin Hudson was not reelected. She's still on the ballot. And she wants to be running for the candidate. So everybody who's listening, you still have to vote for Robin Hudson again. Because she has an opposition.
Exactly. That's a very important point.
Yes.
She's still on the ballot. They tried to knock off.
Well, when they got rid of...
Well, let me address that for 1 second, Michael, about knocking people off. And I want people to pay attention and remember, because I get really frustrated with the local issue mentality, okay? Because everything is local, but everything is also very national. And one of the problems with, you know, our state going back, you know, how it was blue, we voted for Obama, blah, 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 everybody's celebrating, you know, we get the national convention here, it's party time, and then suddenly everything is taken out from under, or, you know, the carpet's pulled out from under. It was very organized. They specifically targeted North Carolina, and they've said that was the ground zero state. They had to retake North Carolina as linchpin to their strategy to hold the South and to win against Democrats sweeping the entire Congress next election. And they've poured hundreds of millions of dollars into these campaigns. And they go in at very local, very small scale levels, but they're organized nationally. This whole, you know, you just mentioned the Tea Party didn't exist before Obama. Absolutely true. Organized movement. We know who started it. We know where it came from. Wasn't grassroots anything. But they very specifically target things. Perfect example, Kay Hagan, Senate race, they already in ads alone spent more than every Senate race in the entire nation combined on her one race. So, I mean, this is what we're talking about. And that's why I want to read this. I've been sitting on this all week because it's just infuriating me. But this is a perfect example of how the Tea Party works. This is verbatim off of one of their sites, the freedomoutpost.com. This is a Tea Party site which has got all the, you know, don't tread on me snakes and all that crap that they constantly attack President Obama. Okay? This is an article from October 22nd, 2013. Obama leaves American POW Sergeant Beau Robert Bergdahl to rot in Afghanistan and provides only excuses. Now, it goes through an entire article attacking Obama for abandoning him for 4 years down there. Said that we've done everything possible trying to get attention to this case, trying to get him released, and Obama sweeps it under the carpet, you know. And then at the end of it, it says, after 4 years of Hillary Clinton's blocking, doing everything else, you know, even they've gotten McCain involved, and McCain saying they should release him, and they said, it's been widely reported that the Taliban-affiliated Haqqanis holding Sergeant Bergdahl have been demanding the release of Guantanamo detainees in return for the 27-year-old soldier, and that President Obama had already lifted a moratorium on Gitmo back in May, but even though 90 detainees at Gitmo are ready to be released, he's refusing to transfer any of them or to bargain with any terrorists. And they're calling him out on him. and they just go through this blasting him. And then you go and play this last week or two.
Right.
They will, it doesn't matter what the man does.
Right.
I mean, that was verbatim. He left him to rot in Afghanistan. He frees him, and they turn around and say, he frees a traitor. You know, I mean,
right.
It doesn't matter what he does. They are a disinformation, attack, and destroy organization. You know what they did, that swift boating to Kerry's campaign?
Yep.
That's what they do. That's their entire operation. And people need to wake up. There is no win. It's scorched earth. There's no, like, you know, local issue. It's all like an atomic bomb blast. And you better start defending everything that you can and voting every time you can, or there's going to be nothing left. They're going to frack it and destroy it right out from under you.
Mr. Adams, what can you leave us with on this D-Day about anything about D-Day that you can remember or that we can take from D-Day?
Well, again, you know, again, like Dr. Ben had said, that, you know, we all have our different opinions about different aspects of our government and democracy and voting itself. I believe that, you know, our society has become totally disconnected in terms of the citizens and our government. And, you know, as long as we continue to fight foreign wars and bring veterans back to this country who are critically wounded and not have the financial ability or the physical or the facilities to take care of these people who supposedly fought for the defense of democracy, we're going to continue to see a division in this country. We have two wars right now that we're supposed to be pulling out of. And I just pray to God that this problem with the Veterans Affairs Administration is resolved.
Robin, what do you have?
Hi. I just want to say that, you know, thank you for those who have passed and laid their lives out over the years on foreign wars and the wars that we are in now. But the realistic thing is, you know, they're out there fighting for us, but if we're not here voting, then what is it for? If we're not here to support our country like they're supporting our country with their lives, then what is it for? So my comment is, take today, bring it to your heart, but understand if you're not voting, then you're a criminal as far as I'm concerned. You are not doing what you're supposed to do, and you're turning your back on these men and women who are fighting for this country.
Well, when you got people over there in Afghanistan and Iraq with purple fingers who have never voted before, while they're voting, getting shelled and shot at, we can at least take a nice day and vote.
Exactly. We need to do our job here. We need to do our job here, and we need to do it now.
Dr. Ben, what do you got for the minutes here?
I agree with Robin. I think she's well said. I just want to thank that North Carolina is a special state. This is my home state. I believe that the majority of people in North Carolina really want freedom, justice, and equality for all the people here. And I think that we have to redouble our efforts so people understand the importance of voting, the importance of democracy, not just at election time, but all the days between election time. We have to have a state of readiness all of the time. And I'm hoping that tomorrow is the North Carolina Democratic Convention. People from across the state of North Carolina will be revived, have a lot of enthusiasm, and go back to their precincts, go back to their counties, and prepare for the November election to begin to turn the state around. I'm optimistic. I believe it's going to happen. And I'm hoping that we all do all of it. First in prayer and first in daily life to improve the quality of life for all the people in the world. So I want to thank everybody for listening, and I look forward to seeing everybody who's in town in Raleigh for the convention today.
Well, Thomas, what do you got?
Well, I just wanted to say thanks to everybody, everyone that serves or has served. They do the hard work. We sit at home and talk about it. But this is a day to remember that, And to echo what I read to you earlier about President Clinton on the 50th anniversary, he said the most important thing that made all the difference at D-Day was not that we showed up with more weapons or something. It was that our men got up over and over again and marched forward. And it's that progress that we need to do. And no matter how many times they set us back, no matter how many times they take away your right to vote or make you read a passage from the Bible or something before you can vote, no matter what they're going to do to you, get up and do your civic duty. Do the right thing. Or else all of those people who died, all of those people who have fought in these wars, died in vain because you gave up the fight at home. You gave the country away. So do your duty and show up at the voting place.
That's wonderful, Thomas. And I just want to let everybody know that we have a few more minutes left in here. But there's two things I wanted to read. There's an old truth that the old truths are easy to understand once they are discovered. The point is to discover them. And we need to go out and discover, pick out, choose the right person that's going to represent us. If we don't go out and look for that person, we get what we get. And you can't complain after you've gotten it. One other thing is that the harder the sacrifice, the more glorious the triumph. That was said by Roosevelt. So, hey, sacrifice, it shouldn't be a sacrifice to go out and vote. It shouldn't be a sacrifice. I hear too many people telling me that, oh, you know, I just didn't think about it. I said, you got to vote every single year. You have a birthday every year. You remember that? You remember Thanksgiving every year? Well, Thanksgiving is the same month that you vote. Every year you're voting for city council, county commissioner, judge, governor, president. You got to remember that. That's one thing. Remember November. We have to remember. This is not a democracy. This is a representative republic. That means we choose the people who are going to run the government for us. And like I said, if you stick your hand in a lion's cage and he bites it off, don't go out and shoot the lion. That's not the lion's fault. We need to understand that. And I want to thank
you. So you're saying when you vote in Halliburton and they steal all your money, that's just not their fault?
No, it's not their fault. It's not their fault. I want to thank everybody, and Robin, I hope I see you very soon. Are you coming over here?
No, I'm right around the corner from the hotel.
You're going to the hotel? Okay. Well, I will see you over there, and I'll give you a call.
Okay.
All right. I want to thank everybody for listening in. This, we started out with a special day, D-Day, 70th anniversary. I want everybody to have a great, great weekend. And if you're in North Carolina, come to the Democratic Party convention tomorrow. It's going to be a fabulous affair. It's going to be at the convention center, 9 o'clock. Be there. I want to thank everybody. Have a great weekend.
Take care.